Yeah, thanks very much, James. Yeah, as James said, I'm a healthcare worker. I've been working in public hospitals in Melbourne for about 6 years now. I had the very interesting experience of being made redundant from one of those public hospitals at the height of the pandemic last year. That's a whole nother session about healthcare under capitalism. But yeah, it's going to be a really great session today. We're joined by Sade, who's a healthcare worker in Melbourne as well, but also two really fantastic speakers from Greece and Chicago. Yeah, so our first speaker, we've had to pre-record these sessions. As any healthcare worker could tell you, trying to manage shift work and life generally is difficult, but they've very kindly offered to pre-record their sessions. So first up, we're going to hear from Elizabeth. I'm going to butcher her surname, Lazals, who she's a veteran nurse and socialist in Chicago and has helped organise health worker protests. So I might hand it over to her.
Hello, comrades. My name is Elizabeth Lawlish. I'm a registered nurse, a union steward with my union, National Nurses United, and a lifelong socialist in Chicago, Illinois, in the United States. First, I want to thank Jerome Small and the organizers of the Marxism 21 conference for inviting me to speak. I'm also deeply honored to be speaking with healthcare comrades from Greece and Australia today. And I am so very sorry that I can't join you live virtually right now. I'm working and was unable to find someone to cover my shift, but I hope to be joining you later in this discussion. I really want to hear what people have to say, and I'm looking forward to it. It's been about a year since the pandemic really hit the United States. It's only been a year, but for healthcare workers here, it feels like a lifetime. We have not only been on the so-called front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic, trying to figure out how to fight this new, very unknown and deadly virus. My unit has been converted twice over the last year into a COVID-only unit. And it's been truly the biggest challenge, I believe, of our lives. But in addition to that, here in the United States, where our healthcare system puts profits before human life, we really have borne the brunt of the pandemic and have been essential to keeping the economy going at the cost of our health and our lives. It's been about a year since I tested positive with COVID-19, and I got COVID-19 at my workplace, a large public sector hospital here in Chicago. It's the busiest hospital in the state of Illinois. And there's no doubt of this. I can recall the exact details of which patient and what room to this day. Why else do I know? Because there was no clear plan with how my hospital was supposed to be dealing with COVID. Patients weren't screened when admitted to my hospital because we were told that tests were too expensive unless patients were showing symptoms. This was true of most hospitals and healthcare facilities in this country. And it's only been in the last couple of months that my hospital has begun to test patients who are admitted to the hospital in just the last few months. And we're a year into this pandemic. At that time, when I tested positive, my unit manager asked me if it was possible if I was exposed in the community. She said, maybe you got it at the gas station while pumping gas. And of course, this made me furious. And I let her know that the hospital is a petri dish and it couldn't possibly have come from the community. But I know I wasn't the only one. Everyone was being asked this. All the doctors who tested positive, all the respiratory therapists, all the phlebotomists, all the transporters, everyone. Why? Because the healthcare bosses in the United States didn't want to pay us for the time that we might have to take off because we would get sick. And it really just exemplifies how the bosses have dealt with this crisis overall here. Arguably, it's the largest occupational disaster in this country's history. What they want to do is blame individual workers who are getting sick rather than taking any responsibility for what they've done to us, which is to not have a plan and to expose us to a deadly virus that can make us very ill with lasting effects and potentially can actually infect our friends and our family. The most recent thing that has been said to us in the hospital, and this is just in the last month or so, is that nurses are testing positive with COVID because they happen to be hanging out at lunch break without masks together in the break room. I mean, it's just an insult, and things that continue to be said to us like that just make everyone really enraged. The second wave, which hit the U.S. in early November, was worse than the first wave, which happened in about March or April when I got sick. It hit widely across the United States, and it really stretched healthcare workers to their limits, revealing just how broken the system is overall. And despite the fact that those who are running hospitals were talking about the fact that a second wave would happen come flu time, you know, the flu season, they had no plans in place, and they did little to prepare for it, especially when it came to providing adequate staff to take care of our patients. Many of my coworkers have retired or resigned because they just do not want to actually deal with COVID anymore. So we were severely short-staffed, and it created all sorts of crisis. For me individually, I had a patient who was very sick on my unit, which was a COVID-only unit, during the second wave. And he needed to be moved into the ICUs, into the critical care units, and I couldn't move him because there were not enough nurses to take care of him in the critical care units. The doctors called me into that patient's room and said to me, "We're going to have to wait till this patient codes," which means the patient's heart stops or he stops breathing, in order to transfer him. I mean, I cannot get that experience out of my head. And that has everything to do with what it was and continues to be the lack of preparation on the part of our employers in the healthcare industry in the United States. They could have had a plan, and they didn't have a plan. I was recently interviewed by the New York Times by a reporter who the main thrust of her story was to ask how much had changed for nurses over the last year. And I said, very little. My union, National Nurses United, which represents about 170,000 registered nurses across the country, recently resurveyed nurses. They had been surveying us to really get a sense of what was going on inside of the hospitals, because obviously the government wasn't under Trump, and the Trump administration was not tracking any kind of information about the conditions and who was getting sick. So they recently resurveyed us, and the results are really a condemnation of the for-profit healthcare system again in this country. Just a couple of the highlights. Employers, and this is from November, December, and the results were put out in the early part of this year, January and February. Employers continue to fail to provide nurses with optimal personal protective equipment to do our job safely. Over 80% of the nurses in my union surveyed report that they are still being forced to reuse single-use PPE, in particular the N95 mask, which I'm sure people know about, which is the main way we can protect ourselves from COVID. Employers are still demanding that we actually reuse these. It's a crime. Slightly more than half of the registered nurses who work in hospitals, about 52%, report that all their patients are screened for COVID. Only 52%. And only 66% of the registered nurses who work in hospitals report that their facility has a dedicated COVID unit or area. Our employers, to this day, the unit that exists on my floor for those patients is a mixed unit, COVID and non-COVID patients, which we have fought them on repeatedly, that it is the most unsafe thing for patients to be exposed in that way. And you can't combine patients on a COVID unit who don't have COVID. Nurses are still not getting tested, and they're not being informed in a timely manner when they're exposed to COVID-19 at work. There's no what they call contact tracing. No one told my coworkers when I became positive. I had to. And that still continues to this day. Why? Because the employers don't want us to become sick, and they don't want our coworkers to become sick or call off because they suspect that they're sick or frightened that they might have COVID. So that continues, and COVID-19 continues to harm the mental health of nurses in this country. There is something that we have termed moral distress and injury, which, I mean, some people call it burnout. What moral distress and injury means is that it comes from us knowing the right thing to do, but receiving no support from our employers to do it, or even being prevented by our employers from doing it. That is the way we feel when we fight around why you shouldn't mix COVID and non-COVID patients together, and we don't actually succeed in stopping our management from doing that. Many times we have, but when we can't, it creates a sense of moral distress and injury because we know what's right. Our employers are refusing to listen to us. The other part of what's happened is also those who have died. And it's the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, which is a highly political body and remains that way. I'll talk about that in a minute, under the Biden administration, has reported over the last year that about 1,400 healthcare workers have died from COVID. But according to my union, which has surveyed nurses and also through looking in the media and finding out, you know, unfortunately, which of my colleagues have not made it, has actually calculated the number to be 3,200, almost twice as many nurses alone have died in the last year. And this has been affecting disproportionately registered nurses of color. This is as of February of this year. And so when you think about it, all these things show that as much as you would hope that things had changed in this country, things really haven't gotten fundamentally better in the healthcare system. And it really does need to be changed completely. And now there's a possible third wave. There's a lot of discussion about the fact that our COVID numbers are going up. They're doubling. Over the last 2 weeks in Chicago alone, there's been a 45% increase, particularly amongst younger adults. And this is happening in a number of states throughout the U.S. I've heard about New York and New Jersey being one of the places where it is actually quite high. And New York was really hit hard this time last year in a way that was surreal and apocalyptic, I called it. And why is this happening? It's really the push to reopen the economy for U.S. capitalism. Now, that existed under Trump, obviously. But what the Biden administration has been able to do is to push this in a way that I don't think the Republicans were able to do. And that is under the cover of really Biden calling himself the most labor-friendly president ever. That's literally what he said. And so what he's been saying is things like, we're going to reopen all the schools for K through 12, kindergartners through 12th grade, in my first 100 days. And he has pushed very hard on that. And that's all a precursor to reopening restaurants and bars and everything, which obviously means the more you open those things up, the more there's possible risks of exposure and people getting just, you know, sloppy in not protecting themselves, not masking, not social distancing. I know the vaccine is out there, but it's like a run against time, so to speak. I mean, people are being vaccinated, and the results are very good in this country of those who get vaccinated, how it decreases the possibility of being infected. I mean, it doesn't ensure that you'll never get COVID. It's just like the flu shot. But still, we still have to vaccinate many, many more people. And so people obviously are getting a message that, you know, okay, everything's opening up. I can ease up and we can go back to quote unquote normal. Well, there is no normal after this pandemic and with COVID now in the world. So, and then on top of that, you have people like Dr. Fauci, who is Biden's chief medical officer, advisor. He was for the Trump administration, but he was derided. He's giving cover for Biden and for the Centers for Disease Control, which, like I said, remains a highly politicized body that recently recommended that teachers don't have to be vaccinated to go back in the classrooms, that children only need to social distance up to 3 feet and not 6 feet, things like that, that once you're vaccinated, it's okay for people to hang out indoors without masks on because you now are protected. I mean, recommendations that as a healthcare worker, I would say we need to proceed with some caution until we get more people vaccinated. But really the drive is to reopen the economy. We're in an economic crisis. And therefore, what's going to end up happening is you're going to have more people who get sick. And it's particularly the case amongst people who are Black and brown, working class and poor in this country, who've already been disproportionately impacted by COVID, who we are still trying to get vaccinated. A lot of it is about lack of trust, and all those things are completely understandable in this country, given the level of racism and distrust that people in these communities have with the just in general with government, but also with the entire healthcare system as a whole. It really hasn't shown that they should trust it. But really, I also want to get into what has changed, because I know I don't have a lot of time left. When that reporter said, what's changed? There is something that's changed. And that's really my coworkers' consciousness and a lot of healthcare workers' consciousness. I think the pandemic has ripped off the mask on the idea that somehow your employer is there to protect you, that they will have your best interest and your life at heart, right? That they, but people have seen that they don't really care if we live or die. Hundreds of my coworkers, of nurses alone, but have been tested positive over the last year with COVID, as well as all the support staff, all the doctors in the hospital. And the same applies for our patients as well. I think that people have seen that it's fostered a readiness for us as nurses and healthcare workers to fight our bosses inside and outside our workplaces. So over the last year, we've developed in my hospital increasing layers of active union nurses who have been engaged in a lot of small fights. We fought around everything from PPE to COVID pay to, making sure that we have adequate gowns, that we don't have to reuse them. All these are little fights, or seemingly little, but they're huge when it comes to your life and making sure that you're safe. And these seemingly smaller fights over the last year have led to bigger fights. So the fights for safety, really basic safety, like I said, have moved into broader fight for, we're in contract negotiations. So we started in November. So it's a fight for a fair contract and for respect in my hospital. And respect is huge, because through this pandemic, we don't feel that our employer has respected us. They don't listen to us. They try to denigrate our clinical knowledge about what it really means to go through this pandemic and maintain infection control and make sure that our patients are taken care of and kept safe. So we're building into a strike vote. It's been in a couple month process, but to be honest with you, we believe that striking is the only way to move our bosses to get what we as workers want and need for us and our patients. And despite, we want to do this despite ongoing attacks by our management to try to break our union. They tried to fire five of our nurses in October, we presented our contract platform to them. It was a petition. And they tried to go after the people who presented the petition to them, accusing them of trying to intimidate them. We won that fight by pushing back very hard. And we found out that the person who really wants to break our union is our boss, who is a Democrat. We work for public sector. She's a politician. She's the head of the Democratic Party in Cook County. Her name is Toni Preckwinkle. She's an African-American woman. She was a former teacher and looked at as being the progressive in the city to run as mayor. She was supported by the teachers union. And, you know, she has basically said, we need to break all the unions in the hospital because they're getting in the way of us being able to recover from this pandemic. And so if we do strike, it would be the first time we've struck since the 1990s. So it's been some decades, and it's a big deal for public sector workers to go out, especially given our patient population, which are the people who are most affected by COVID. And we're not the only ones who are talking about this. There have been numerous strikes in healthcare because we've been inside our workplaces. We've been able to collectively fight and organize. And so the hospital down the street, which is the University of Illinois Chicago Hospital, went out on strike in September. They went out with their support staff. So they united across two unions with a fight that actually won them both very good contracts. The Alameda Health Service out in the East Bay in California, which is also a public sector union, went out along with members of my union out in California, and they won recently incredible contracts. And currently, there's a strike at St. Vincent's in Western Massachusetts, where nurses are on an open-ended strike, which is unusual, and it's their third week. And so one of the nurses, Maria Ricardo, said this, which I think just resonates with every nurse and every healthcare worker in this country. She said, quote, there's no way we're going to back down until they provide us with insurances and language in our contract that will ensure nurses, by and large, have no more than four patients at a time. We will not be coming back into this facility. And they're still out on strike, and we're still trying to build solidarity with them. And then lastly, just to say for my union, it's the largest registered nurses union in the country. We this year have 65,000 of our members across the country who are going to be going into contract negotiations at the same time. And so my union is looking at that as a opportunity to actually galvanize workers, us as nurses across the country, and all of the members of our union to really begin to build collective national opposition to the healthcare industry. I participated in a Zoom call of leaders throughout my union of about 500 of us, and there were two other calls with the same number of nurses on my union talking about how are we going to take steps to begin to do these strikes. And try to coordinate them across the country. It's something to look for. And then, you know, it's not just nurses. And I'll wrap up with this. It's really what's been happening at a subterranean level throughout workplaces of essential workers, meaning people who have continued to work throughout the pandemic. I have been in my workplace ever since the pandemic began, and I haven't stopped over the last year. And it's best, I think, illustrated by a struggle that's been getting a lot of national and international attention, and that is the struggle of Amazon workers in Bessemer, Alabama, who are fighting to win union recognition from the richest man in the world, Jeff Bezos, who has made money hand over fist because of what his company provides to people during the pandemic. These are essential workers, mainly Black women, who are angry over the working conditions and the lack of safety within the Amazon facility, as well as just lack of respect, all the things that happen, how they're pushed to work faster and faster. And they've also been inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement of the last summer, so they called up a union and asked them to represent them. It's the story of really, I think, that this story echoes with everyone and why it's become such a lightning rod here in the United States that the whole labor movement and everyone is watching is because it speaks to what we've gone through and the potential for us to begin to fight back and rebuild the labor movement and really with a vision of a different kind of world, because people know that unions protect them, but they're also a place where people we can care for each other, which I think gets to more of like what has also happened in this pandemic. And I'll end with this, which is like people concluding that the world, the system we live under, capitalism, has failed them. It's ripped that face off. And my coworkers know that the system, that something is deeply wrong with it. And that, you know, people got money from the federal government that was literally given to hospitals in some of the COVID relief bills that we have never seen, right? And all the conditions that I talked about before. And it's really at the core, something is brewing. That is that the idea, at least for healthcare workers, I'll come back to that, that we need something different. We need a healthcare system not run for profit, but for human need. And, you know, we not only begin to talk about what that would look like, but how can we begin to fight for that and win, which is what my union's talking about, taking on this huge industry that makes enormous profits off of people's lives. And I think that, you know, when you get to the discussion about what would socialism look like, right? How would it have handled the pandemic differently? It would have had a plan. People would have been tested and there would have been contact tracing. There would be now equitable distribution of vaccines with education if people were hesitant. And I'm not just talking about in the United States, I'm talking about around the world. The rich nations shouldn't be the ones that get the vaccine first and then poorer nations have to wait. We can't wait on a pandemic. A socialist society would have addressed that, or a socialist world would have been able to figure that things, those sorts of things out. It, the healthcare part of the pandemic would have been led by people like me, healthcare workers, direct people. We're smart people. We're the experts. We're the ones telling our bosses what they need to do, and they're not paying attention to it, and they refuse to because it means they can't make money. And so our direct experience would be the things that drive how we treat and how we care for COVID patients. And we would have been, we would have in place healthcare for all, food and housing for all, for those who have lost their jobs, who are on unemployment benefits. And we would have put resources into schools if they are needed, rather than driving teachers back and other educators back into substandard, underfunded schools, right, with poor ventilation, no running water, that sort of thing, right? Those things would have been moved into those, into the places where it's needed. So it's so clearly obvious how a socialist society would be different. And so it is that vision that I think is incredibly important for us to keep in our minds as we begin to hopefully come out of this pandemic more and begin to figure out how we're going to begin to fight back. Because the employers have figured out how to actually change work and they how to make it, you know, maximize their money. They're looking at things like in healthcare that would allow them to have, you know, people call you, like telemedicine, they call it, for your appointments, rather than having real human beings, you know, you have to come into the office for a doctor appointment or to see a nurse. All of that is stuff that they are going to try to actually expand in the healthcare industry so they can cut down on the numbers of workers that they need. And we need to fight those things, as well as fight for unions, as well as when we have unions, fight more. And we need more socialists who are arguing and pushing for these things. I mean, the socialist left in this country is more or less quite weak. It's new. There is a large organization called the Democratic Socialist of America. It's still a very new organization, and we need to build deeper roots into the working class, I believe, to be able to have the impact we want to actually fight for a different kind of world for working people. And we have a vision of what that looks like, and we know we want to get there, and it's really about how we begin to rebuild that. Thank you very much.
So our next speaker is Antonis and from Greece. He's a member of the DEA, which is the International Workers Left and a revolutionary socialist organisation in Greece. Antonis is a pathologist and he's active in the Federation of Hospital Workers Union in Greece. So I'll hand it over to him.
Dear comrades, We are sending you our warmest greetings from Greece and wish all the best to your conference. In my brief intervention, I would like to give you a picture on the struggles and the resistance that have developed in Greece during this 1 year of the pandemic. In terms of union organizing, there are two big unions in the Greek national health system, the Federation of Hospital Workers, which organizes 250 local unions and about 80,000 workers. It's controlled by a majority of unionists that are affiliated to the Social Democratic Party and the Right Wing Party. The Federation of Hospital Doctors is the second, which organizes 50,000 members. It is led by unionists affiliated to the Communist Party in the leadership and a collective of unionists of the anti-capitalist and radical left, which I belong also. 1 year ago, the conservative government of the New Democracy argued that the national health system is fully prepared and armored that the people will be safe. The first wave of the pandemic in March and April of 2020 was faced with a complete lockdown. The pandemic was controlled mostly because people were scared, as they knew the problems of NHS and followed the measures. But the restriction of movement in order to contain the pandemic should not become justification to impose permanent repressive measures against the people. We needed to mobilize to stop this from happening. While the moderate Federation of Hospital Workers decided to suspend all activities because of the pandemic, the anti-capitalist left, the Hospital Doctors Federation, took the initiative to organize a mobilization. On 6th of April, in the last year, the Doctors Federation called for rallies outside the hospitals all over the country to demand support for the NHS. The rallies were successful and were supported by other unions and local associations. It was a very important mobilization as it was the first to break the quarantine of protests and challenged the conservative government effort to impose complete silence. Right after the complete lockdown of all movement, the next phase was marked by complete opening of all economic activities. This happened under the pressure of hotel owners and major airlines who were looking forward to profits during the tourist season. So the tourism industry was fully open without essential testing and controls. Meanwhile, the weak public transport system was overcrowded every day. No health protocols and no safety measures were implemented at all in workplaces. Then schools reopened without any provision to organize smaller classes with a few students each and without any testing. As a result, the second wave of the pandemic struck the country really hard. We reached a mortality rate of 40 deaths per 1,000 cases, which was a negative global record at that time. The government was forced to announce a new lockdown on the 7th of November, which lasted until Christmas. But this time it was not an actual lockdown in economy. Movement during daytime to go to work and return home was regular, and there was a curfew during the night and a restriction for other social interactions outside in the open. The virus was spreading from the workplaces, inside the houses, and among family members. At the same time, the government of New Democracy was instrumentalizing the second wave of the pandemic to ban all protests. The important mobilizations of November the 17th, anniversary of the student revolt against dictatorship in 1973, and December the 6th, anniversary of the youth revolt against the police murder of a 15-year-old student in 2008, were banned and faced severe police repression. The government banned protests by decree and repressed any rally with over 100 people. At the same time, it started prosecuting healthcare unionists for ridiculous reasons. Some were prosecuted even for talking about the lacks and the problems of the health system in the media. On January, there was a new outburst of the pandemic. We organized new strikes and rallies outside the hospitals to denounce the serious lack of hospital personnel and intensive care units. On February, there were protests to defend local primary health care, which is very important to fight a pandemic in the communities, and which is suffering from serious lack of doctors and personnel. In many cases, regular clinics had to postpone appointments with patients because of the pressure. This was the case in the local health center of the district where I work. It was transformed to a vaccination center, but it was no new recruits and staff to support the effort. So all personnel was forced to work on vaccination, and our appointments with patients had to be canceled. The municipality was left without primary health care. Around the day of national action in support of local primary health care, we organized. Our appeal won the support of the Communist Party unionists. Delegations were sent to inform the public about the situation and our demands and struggle. Municipality workers declared a work stoppage in support, and many local unions and associations supported our public rally outside the health center. We forced the government to deploy extra personnel for vaccination, and regular clinics started functioning again to cover appointments of local patients. As the pandemic progressed, all the NHS has been gradually transformed into a health system dealing with a singular disease, the COVID disease. Today, almost all hospital wards have become COVID wards, while the government is pushing people in it to hands of private clinics. In late February, there was a new health care strike in Thessaloniki, the second big city of Greece. What happened that day showed the way we must move forward. The striking health workers united with a motorized protest of delivery workers, and together they joined the students who were protesting against the violent police assault inside their campus the previous day, all together from the big bars of 10,000 people united. Today, we are facing the third wave, which hits mostly the capital city of Athens. Because of the new mutations of the virus and the pre-existing spreading of the virus in the community, intensive care units and hospital beds today are almost full, close to 100%. The government puts all the blame in young people, accusing them falsely for organizing parties and accuses mostly public protests, now that they are happening again freely. This was achieved because masses of people broke the state bans with their mobilization from below, after an incident of extreme police brutality during a police check against a young man in the district of Athens, was recorded on video. There was a massive protest of thousands in the local public square. The next days, there were massive rallies in the districts and neighborhoods all over the country, and this social movement managed to cancel in practice the repressive measures that government implemented using the virus as an excuse. In this defiant mood of generalized fight back, the Federation of Hospital Workers called for a mass rally in the central Syntagma Square, downtown Athens, on 19th of March. We wanted to protest both against the tragic situation in healthcare and the violation of democratic rights. As a result, many people showed up to support the health workers in solidarity and express their anger for both issues, healthcare and democracy. From that point forward, we continue our struggle from a better place. Many people are now realizing that the government is unable to handle the pandemic. It is fooling us with lies, and it keeps voting new anti-worker legislations during all this time. At the same time, these people are building their confidence to fight by challenging and breaking state bans to protest. In this effort to build a generalized fight back against the neoliberal and authoritarian government, the struggle of healthcare workers has been crucial. Healthcare issues are at the forefront of public debate, and the need for strong, free public health care is a major issue for most people in these difficult times. So the struggles at this front have been central for all the resistance movement. In this situation, it's very important that inside the Federation of Hospital Doctors, the anti-capitalist left is strong and united and can push forward and organize joint actions with the Communist Party unionists. It is crucial that militant doctors are the ones who constantly expose the criminal responsibilities and the lies of the government. It's also crucial for the wider resistance movement that militant doctors, with their authority on the issue, are the ones who defy the state bans in practice and insist on the importance of strikes and protests. We will continue organizing the fighting around our three main demands. First, a big rise in the funding of national health system and massive hiring of permanent personnel. Second, the requisition of all private healthcare facilities to put them under a centralized national plan to confront the pandemic. Massive and free testing for all citizens and stricter interventions in workplaces where the virus spreads and reproduces, instead of measures that aim solely to repression of public gatherings and lock people inside their homes solely during their leisure time. I believe we managed to give you the general picture of the situation and the struggles in our country. We send you commonly and militant greetings and our internationalist solidarity to your struggles. We wish you to have a very successful conference. Thank you.
I just wanted to take the opportunity now to let Sade introduce herself.
My name's Sade. I'm a doctor at a Victorian public hospital. I've been working in public health for about 5 years and was working through the pandemic. Obviously, I think, you know, we're going to cover a lot of ground. I think before we start, it's really good to just talk about what healthcare was like in Australia before the pandemic struck, because it's sort of come in the setting of decades and decades of neoliberal sort of divergence of funds away from public healthcare. It was sort of posited as this argument to alleviate the pressure on public health and improve accessibility to healthcare, but what we've seen is a decrease in beds from 8.1 per 1,000 people across Australia in sort of 1997 down to 2.6 in 2019 per 1,000 people. So you're looking at a healthcare system that is already sort of bare bones, I've never been at work where we haven't been using our surge capacity. We've got this inbuilt system of surge capacity for emergencies, but since I've been working for 5 years, it's always been in utilization. So that's just part of the system. Workers are already working sort of 60 to 70 hours a week at sort of bare bones with an average of 10 hours of overtime a week. So with looking at a population that's really, really on the brink before we're even sort of getting to any sort of crisis healthcare, I'll let Cecilia, because I don't know what it was like at her workplace, but certainly.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. And I think the other thing to say too is the other thing we've seen in healthcare is just the ongoing impact of neoliberal attacks over the years. You know, increased privatisation of different services within healthcare settings, pathology, cleaning, different aspects of hospitals. But then also, you know, I think aged care is such a brilliant example of, neoliberal attacks and the impacts of privatisation. And if anything, it's no wonder, that residents in aged care facilities, especially in Victoria, were so exposed to the impacts of COVID when it hit. And it was interesting listening to Elizabeth when she was talking about the lack of plans that they had in the States, because in the two hospitals that I've been working in Melbourne during COVID, there've been very clear plans. Mm. There were very clear plans from the outset of how things were going to be managed. Did you want to comment on that?
I think it is sort of a problem because these plans, there was no sort of centralised agency, and so even in terms of sort of resource allocation and plans between hospitals and between different states, it was a real mess because there was no coherent strategy. Like, even from a national level, you look, we've got a healthcare system where 35% of our hospital beds are private beds, right? And 27%, I think, of ICU beds in 2020 were private beds. So to not cohere between public and private hospitals just enabled the sort of behaviour that is frankly criminal. Like, in our sort of network, our local private hospitals call themselves non-COVID hospitals, so they would refuse to see anyone who has had symptoms or was suspected COVID or was high risk, was diverted to the public health system. At the same time that they were closing their ICU beds, they were closing their EDs, they were closing their ICUs because they didn't want to put at risk what was lucrative for them, which was elective surgeries. Any sort of COVID infection that would sweep just means that they have less capacity for elective surgery rates. So to the sort of, and also an argument to be said is elective surgeries also require all the most in demand equipment for the pandemic. So ventilators are needed in surgery, masks are needed in surgery, all the anesthetic drugs are needed in surgery. So we're in this situation where 35% of beds are being closed, underutilized to facilitate and use the equipment that is most needed in a devastating pandemic for profit-geared incentives, elective surgeries that can be very, very easily pushed off because the government is not willing to stand up to private hospitals and cohere a plan across the state and fucking nationalize the public, the healthcare system in the biggest pandemic that we've seen in 100 years. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I know I certainly saw you speak of those inconsistencies. I saw that within hospitals as well. You know, different hospitals like would put all their attention and focus into, say, their emergency department. So ensuring that, you know, staff there had appropriate PPE and there were kind of protocols and plans in terms of dealing with COVID patients coming into the hospital. But then the rest of the hospital, like there was no plan, there was no, nothing was given. And, you know, like at the Royal Melbourne, which I don't work at, you know, they had the biggest health cluster, you know, at in their aged care wards, which is kind of like, for those who don't know, is kind of like the other end of the hospital pathway, like the opposite end of emergency, because there was no, there was no plan of what are we going to do if COVID gets into the aged care wards, you know, and it went through like, you know, like fire. And, you know, as a result, there was actually, I mean, people don't know this, there was a morgue erected in their car park just to cope with the number of bodies that they were having to pull out every day. And, you know, like that has massive impacts on, you know, obviously on patients and families and that sort of stuff, but also on like workers having to manage the emotional toll. Like I know in your setting there were high infection rates amongst.
So I think it's important to also acknowledge that in the beginning of the pandemic, epidemiologists were estimating sort of 20 to 70% infection rates, right? So all the plans that were put in place in the early stage of the pandemic, that's the number that they're working with. We had like 0.2% population infection rate, and this was the outcome. So the sort of criminal lack of planning cannot be understated when the whole system has come to its knees with, you know, like 2% of what they were expecting. It's just insane. But yeah, similarly, so I worked through the whole pandemic, and I think I've worn an N95 mask probably six times in that entire time. So in terms of resource allocation and sort of protection for healthcare workers, it was non-existent. My hospital had two staff outbreaks, and so we're looking in Victoria, there's about 15% healthcare worker infection rate, and that's higher than the international average. So like 0% in Taiwan, and Taiwan and South Korea had 0% infection rate, 5% in many, many, many countries, and ours was 15. And it's because we never got masks, we never got protection. There was just this culture where, okay, the young people in the hospital would just sort of cop it. We would say, okay, we don't have masks, we don't have protection, we don't have isolated wards. Our hospital, the pathology was so underrun that the rapid testing, which is those COVID tests that come back in 2 hours, we were only allowed two of them a day. So we're doing these procedures on patients that have suspected COVID, and they're there for 3 days without any N95s, without any isolation, because you only can have access to two of these masks a day. So I think in the beginning, it was stressful enough. We thought, okay, you know, we're sort of used to, as workers, putting our lives on the line, you know, in terms of overtime, fatigue, burnout, all of this kind of stuff. So this was a dramatic but not unheard of extension of that. When we started figuring out what COVID actually was, and in terms of permanent long-term lung scarring, you know, 20-year-old. There was a doctor that I'm friends with who was 29 and was in ICU for 3 weeks. And so that sort of strategy of just, oh, send the young people, don't worry about it, we'll cover it, it just became totally untenable. And there was this sense of real just rage, battleground mentality on the wards, because, you know, people around you were dropping like flies. I don't know what it was like at yours, but, yeah, we had two massive massive, massive outbreaks with, you know, dozens of people sent home, dozens of people infected at each time. Did you have something similar?
I just have to say, like, I'm listening to you talk about all of that, Sade, and like when you hear people talk about, oh, you know, in Australia it wasn't so bad, it really kind of hits home of the actual reality of what was happening in hospitals. There was, in one of the hospitals I worked at, there was a small outbreak, and which it wasn't as disastrous as some of the things you're talking about. But certainly it resulted in, like, I think about 50 staff having to isolate and quarantine, which had massive flow-on impacts for patient care as well, not just sort of, you know, increasing the already, like, standard understaffing, but it meant things like that the only doctors who could order the chemotherapy drugs were suddenly in hotel quarantine. Patients' chemotherapy regimes had to be changed, you know, and like who knows what the like lasting impacts of that. But I think there was sort of ongoing, you know, and we're going to continue to see these ripple effects of, you know, the impact of COVID will have on people, you know, who were having cancer treatments or, you know, had a delayed cancer diagnosis, people with heart conditions and that sort of stuff, you know, and kind of having to manage, you know, that workload, but also manage the emotional toll. A large part of my work was sort of having to manage families who couldn't come in and be with their loved one in the hospital, couldn't, you know, be on the palliative care unit in the hospital because of the restrictions that had to take place. So that was that was my experience. I think we've talked about a lot of like really negative stuff. It was great hearing from Elizabeth and from Antonis about the response of the unions. And my goodness, like if you can't organize healthcare workers in the middle of a pandemic, like this is the time we need to fight back. What do you want to say about that, Shannon?
I mean, yeah, I think so. I think that we can be much, much more maximal with our demands and with our union activity. Like, I think the sort of criminal activity there were in the early days of the pandemic, because the private hospitals were shutting down their wards, they were laying off huge proportions of nurses and pathology workers. So you're looking at the biggest pandemic we've seen in 100 years and healthcare staff being fired. And so the push then was to sort of divert money into keeping the private hospitals operational. So, which is, you know, just giving them bribes to not lay off, you know, staff and trying to accept COVID patients. But so those staff ended up being rehired back, and the union did mount a good campaign to sort of try and utilize those staff. But even sort of the capitulation of, okay, well, this is at the expense of money that was initially allocated to public hospitals, I think was a mistake. I think we can be much more uncompromising about saying, no, look, you know, healthcare cannot be profit driven, and particularly in these times, and to really push for, you know, the utilization of staff and improved conditions, not at the expense of, you know, money to the public health sector and to community health. I think, you know, like they've been talking about public sector wage freezes in many, many states for, you know, teachers and nurses, the people who have been on the most front line and, you know, the hardest working, most vulnerable, most affected people by the pandemic. And I think, you know, I think Cecilia's right. Now is the time to push. There's never been more public sympathy and respect and understanding that there is now, and to accept that we need to cop one for the team, and that we need to subsume our sort of wages and conditions and rights for the profit motive of hospitals is just a mistake. And I think there's a lot of arguments to be said amongst our colleagues. Certainly there's a frustration and a level to be more maximal and push for sort of stronger demands. But, you know, I think you agree, among the community, there's never been a better time to really try and flip the conversation, say, look what neoliberal has done, look what our profit motive system is, and let's try and change that, you know?
Yeah, and I think, like, not just, like, there's the community support, but I think as healthcare workers, we have a huge you know, moral pull in terms of actually making these more maximal arguments. You know, we heard from our comrade in Greece in terms of how it's the healthcare workers who are at the forefront of protests and rallies actually demanding, like, you know, a fighting back against attacks on democratic rights and that sort of thing. You know, and I think healthcare workers always have the potential in terms of, you know, the moral force that we can pull, because our working conditions, everyone's healthcare conditions, you know, and I guess, you know, I'm worried, you know, in terms of the ongoing impact of the cult that is Dan Andrews, which is unfortunately headed by the leadership of the nurses union in Victoria.
Yeah.
You know, such a strong union with an incredibly proud militant history. You know, and I haven't heard boo from them in terms of, like, demanding better pay and conditions. And this is at this, you know, the same time when we're seeing healthcare workers around the world, like in Britain at the moment, fighting back against the, like, insulting 1% pay rise that Boris Johnson, who's only with us today thanks to the NHS. You know, there's an argument. But I think there's so much potential, but it's so disappointing that the lack of leadership coming from our unions, when the arguments are so clear to everyone, but also the anger and I think the potential from people working in hospitals in and in the broader health system is there, and we don't have the leadership and people making the enough people making the arguments.
I think the anger there is really right. There's never been more tangible energy in the hospital against management. Like, I remember during one of our outbreaks, they were, one of my colleagues who was one of the, like, keystone first people that got sick, had worked 93 hours on the infectious disease ward in the week prior. So no wonder he got sick, but then was told, oh, do you think maybe you got it in the community? And, like, it just, the, like, gall and the, you know, the lack of respect that it would show to someone who's, you know, killing themselves. We were on call 24 hours a day because our colleagues were dropping out so quickly that we had to sort of be there to step up, and to then be told, well, no, you don't have access to masks still. No, you know, you don't. Thank you for working so much. Thank you for being on call, but we're not going to give you hazard pay. We're not going to give you, you're going to have to use your sick leave because we think that you might have got it in the community. Because, you know, I think our protection is adequate.
How do you get into the community if you're working 93 hours a week?
And so that divide between, you know, workers and management who say, look, you know, we're all one family, we're healthcare workers, we're in the middle of the pandemic, let's all band together and, you know, work together, and then are not willing to pay, you know, hospital fees or, you know, pay, and, you know, people having to use their sick leave, their annual leave for, you know, infections that they contracted very definitively in the workplace. 3 weeks after that incident, an article came back and said 80% of healthcare worker infections are acquired in the workplace. Like, obviously, you know, the fact that that had to be studied and that wasn't a given is just a lack of, it's, you know, endemic of that lack of respect that any worker, even, you know, in the midst of the pandemic, when they're doing more than ever before, is sort of met with by management and by leadership.
Yeah, and I think, gosh, there's so much more that we can say, but I guess in the interest of time and as a way of summing up, like, one thing we were asked to comment on was what the healthcare system would look like if it was run by workers. And we had a really interesting conversation about this previously, because, I mean, for me, like, my starting point is we can't talk about fair and equitable access to healthcare without talking about broader system change. You know, I think our healthcare is a direct reflection of the broader inequities, the broader impacts that capitalism has on our health individually and as a community. So it's, you know, just like we can't isolate areas of a hospital within a pandemic, I don't think we can isolate our healthcare system more broadly within capitalism.
Yeah.
Did you want to?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you think about you know, the biggest changes to healthcare historically, it hasn't come from vaccines, although, you know, they're fantastic. It's come from sewerage, housing, you know, sort of food sustainability, food availability. I think a really nice example, just in the pandemic, there were these big calls and concerns about sort of mental health during the pandemic, and, you know, all the of the increase in sort of mental health services that would be need to be used in inpatient admission rates. And it's actually gone down because of the, like, Centrelink has been sustainable for the first time. So for the first time in many, many years, people are actually able to buy food, know where their next, you know, bill is coming from, are able to pay rent, are able to, you know, live in a way that, you know, is more than day-to-day without, you know, skipping meals, without sacrificing their medication, you know. And so, look, you know, the effect and anxiety of the pandemic cannot be understated, but you look at the contrary effect of, you know, having sort of financial security for the first time, and the overall effect is actually a stabilization in mental health rather than the reverse. So you just, yeah, I think first you have to look, you know, even before you look at preventative healthcare, even before you look at increasing funding to GPs over hospitals, you have to look at society as a whole and sort of broader systemic change in just capitalism as usual.
Yeah. So I guess to sum up, like, so much potential, yeah, so much worth fighting for. And yeah, all these struggles are connected.
Definitely.
And yeah, we all have a role to play.
Yep, definitely.